the Odyssey is not just a religious concept. In fact, something very like it plays an absolutely vital role in our everyday lives. And the broad argument I want to make is that consumerism, ironically, has become a kind of secular theodicy. In some quite precise ways, consumerism has grappled and continues to grapple with foundational questions about our destiny, about social progress. And if we want to counter consumerism, I shall argue, we have to start from that place. We have to understand that role that consumerism is playing. And we have to offer, of course, some other less damaging ways of grappling with those questions. But first, I want to take you back to a point in history. It's the year 1851, and my story concerns a 10-year-old girl. Interestingly, it's a point in history at which theodicy, in its religious sense, is in the process of hitting the buffers. But I want to tell a more personal story. It's a true story, and it concerns a girl called Annie. I want you to imagine, if you can, a windswept, stormy day in Middle England. I know that's rather hard in the height of this glorious British summer. But I want you to imagine it's raining like it's never rained before. And Annie here is 10 in this year. Before she reaches her 10th birthday, she's already suffering from stomach cramps, headaches, dizziness, and difficulties in breathing. And it's clear to her parents that something has to be done. So one day in late March in 1851, her father prizes a rather tearful Annie from her mother's reluctant farewell. And together with her sister Henrietta and their nurse, Fanny, they set off on the arduous coach journey north to Dr. James Gully's famous water cure establishment in Malvern. Her father's trust in water cure is supreme. Only a few months previously, he himself had been a patient with Dr. Gully. What was wrong with him, we're not entirely sure, probably some kind of nervous dysfunction, something at any rate that was treatable by water cure. At any rate, he is so confident that a water cure will be effective that he heads back to London to get some work done, as fathers tend to do. More on the work later, leaving Annie in the care of her nurse and the good Dr. Gully. But 2 weeks later, he's summoned back to Malvern. Annie has taken a turn for the worse. Poor old Henrietta was dispatched to nearby relatives. Charles, the father's name was Charles, took up a constant vigil by Annie's bedside and wrote every day to his wife to report on the almost hourly struggle between life and death that Annie endured, racked with violent diarrhea, losing strength by the day, writhing in agony on her sickbed. Annie would occasionally make pathetic attempts to sing her favourite hymns, but it was becoming obvious to everyone that she was losing the fight. By the morning of Wednesday, the 23rd of April, the girl lay motionless on her bed, wasted but tranquil, as storm clouds gathered outside. Her father sat by the window, staring at the dull grey Malvern hills, weeping quietly, waiting for the inevitable. And a little time later, as Desmond and Moore describe the scene, the wind picked up. Charles and Fanny moved closer to the bed. Annie lay still, unconscious. It was just 12 o'clock, midday. Thunder began to sound, great peals far above them, the mighty knell of nature. They edged nearer and heard the breathing stop. She was dead. The story of Annie's death is just ordinary human tragedy. An unhappy but not an uncommon tale, certainly not in the mid-19th century, and not even today, when a child dies in poverty every 3 seconds. And almost every single life is touched at some point by personal tragedy. Annie's death also serves to illustrate the subject matter of this paper. Theodicy, in a very personal and quite precise way, was the challenge facing Charles and Emma in the aftermath of Annie's death. And each of them reacted very differently to the challenge. When no word came from Malvern on the day of the death, Emma realised immediately that the struggle was over, so that by the time Charles's letter arrived, she was able to bear the knowledge sweetly and gently, crying without violence, as if it had all happened a long time ago, as she wrote. a devout Christian, she turned to her faith for support, hoping to attain some feeling of submission to the will of heaven. For Charles, however, Annie's death achieved an almost cosmological significance. Hours after the death, he was found still by the bedside, weeping inconsolably. What he later described as an insufferable grief served to shatter his belief in a moral and just universe and convince him of the underlying cruelty of nature. The cruelty of Annie's suffering also sounded the death knell for his already teetering Christianity. But in the wake of her death, he threw himself with ever greater fervour into his life's work. The formulation of one of the most influential scientific theories of the last 200 years, a theory in which suffering and cruelty became the engine of evolutionary progress, a theory in which, as some latter-day philosophers have declared, there was no longer any room for God. It's a very personal story, but the divide between Emma and Charles also serves to symbolize the changing role and status of religion in human affairs. In Emma's world, the right place to look for consolation was still her faith. For Charles, and for an increasing proportion of the Western world in the intervening 150 years, things had changed. The world after Darwin, yes, you've guessed it, the father was Charles Darwin, became an increasingly secular place. God was dead, trumpeted Nietzsche. Religion was knocked to pieces, said George Bernard Shaw. And where there had been a God, a cause, a faith that the universe was ordered, and therefore a sense of moral responsibility as part of that order, there was now, said Shaw, an utter void. Chaos had come again. The effect, at first, was exhilarating. We had, he said, the runaway child's sense of freedom before it gets hungry and lonely and frightened. And in those words lie that question, that same question, the question I started with. Where on earth will it end? The demise of God left open the question of meaning, the function of theodicy in the modern world. And the argument I want to explore, expand on today, is that some part of that function has become internalized within consumerism itself, in some quite precise ways. And that's not to suggest that religious theodicy is no longer relevant, or that a consumerist theodicy is even remotely successful. But if this is happening, if consumerism is operating as theodicy, if this is what's going on, then it's a pretty important thing for us to understand and to face up to. My argument draws on a kind of broadly sociological view of religion. And sociologists like to bracket the question of ultimate reality. Let's not go for the moment to the point of answering whatever the object of our faith might be, and let's look at religion as a societal phenomenon, as a social phenomenon. And in this view, and it's expressed wonderfully by Peter Berger, for example, in a book called The Sacred Canopy, in this view, every society is faced with the problem of constructing and maintaining its social world, what Berger calls the nomos. Nomos comes from the Greek name, and nomization is the process that Berger talks about in terms of the construction of this social world. It can be thought of as a set of assumptions, understandings, rules, maxims, social norms, rituals that together bring a sense of order and meaning to human lives. And religion, as you can imagine, plays several key roles in this nomization process, in world maintenance. In particular, it allows us to make sense of our existence in relation to a higher or sacred order, something that we might call cognitive meaning. It provides a framework for moral governance, moral meaning, and finally, by offering a transcendent reality, it allows us to confront the question of our own mortality and the loss of those we love. Emotional meaning. Berger called this overarching framework, as I mentioned, a sacred canopy. And he suggested that this sacred canopy was vital in every kind of society. The sacred canopy is all that keeps us from the brink of despair, from anomie, meaninglessness, the dark, chaotic meaninglessness that threatens constantly to overturn us. And central to the question, central to the function of world maintenance, is the question of theodicy. And as I've already intimated, religious theodicy was quite precisely linked for a long time with the need to reconcile an omnipotent and benevolent God with the existence and persistence of evil and suffering. But theodicy is also a very important concept in the sociology of religion and can be framed in non-religious terms. For example, Berger defined theodicy as the religious legitimation of anomic phenomenon. That's to say, the attempt to defend the existing world order in the face of these ever-present threats to meaning that assault it. And these threats arise, in particular, of course, as a result of suffering, of loss, of our own mortality. Put differently, theodicy attempts to cope with the discrepancy between our ideals, our perfect world, and the reality with which we're daily confronted. In ordinary, everyday terms, theodicy is about making sense of our lives, faced with persistent injustice, the prosperity of ill-doers, the persecution of the righteous. How should we seek to live? What kind of morality can we live by? Confronted with our own mortality, the persistence of suffering, the sorrow of bereavement, where should we turn for solace? How are we to protect the authority of compassion and the promise of love? Where, in short, do we find meaning in our lives? And to be effective in this role of sense-making, theodicy has to have certain characteristics. I want to talk about six interrelated characteristics of theodicy: justice, reward, consolation, ontological security, transcendence, and eschatology. Eschatology, again, a horribly theological word for which it appears we still have no alternative, is the study of last or final things. And in fact, it's concerned quite precisely with that question that I started out: where on earth will it end? Eschatology is about that question. Now, there's clear links between these different functions, and they work together to defend us against anomie and to protect the sacred canopy. Together, they have to demonstrate that the sacred order doesn't discriminate arbitrarily between individuals. That 6-94 split that you showed us so graphically at the beginning. It has to be about, it has to have a sense of justice. And the key element in maintaining this justice is to ensure that some form of mechanism exists which dispenses rewards or compensations consistently in relation to good or bad behaviours. But this mechanism is clearly challenged in the real world. And the first of these is the persistence, even the flourishing of wrongdoers. The idea that evil can prosper is deeply disturbing to the set of moral meanings established in society. Nonetheless, it can, with some effort, be legitimated within broader secular moral codes and practice. But a more intractable challenge is presented by the arbitrary incursions of suffering and loss with which we're confronted, either individually or collectively, at some point in our lives. And these two, they have two specific forms. One is related to the loss of our loved ones, and the second arises from our awareness of our own mortality. And a credible theodicy must be one which offers plausible consolations in the face of these sufferings. It must also provide us with a working defence against the pervasive anxiety which is engendered by our own mortality, this question of ontological insecurity, existential angst. And some of these compensatory mechanisms established through theodicy might operate in this world. But the challenge of providing an entirely secular compensatory mechanism is immense, particularly in the face of loss. Most theodicies tend to draw in part on compensatory mechanisms which operate in some other transcendental realm, and hence the function of transcendence, or perhaps at some point in the future, and hence eschatology. So the importance of the functions of transcendence and eschatology is quite precisely to establish and maintain a compensatory mechanism, and in doing so to maintain the authenticity the credibility of the existing social realm. I have a student at the University of Surrey who has been doing some work with religious groups on consumerism. And in the course of that study, we had some absolutely wonderful pieces of data, people's reflections on the relationship to their faith. And I just want to cite this one because it captures, for me, many of the theodical functions of a religious faith. You know, sometimes, something that really opened my eyes the other day, driving down the M3 motorway, the traffic was terrible. And my husband is not going to church this Sunday. Or my eldest daughter is not going to baptize my grandchildren. And that makes me very, very sad, very unhappy. And on the motorway near Winchester, going past, and these grey skies, a horrible time, raining. And there is this little bit of light. And there on the motorway, there is a cross somewhere on a hill. And the light was shining on the cross, and I was sitting down there under the rain. I have a meeting at 9 o'clock, and I'm sitting down there watching this light shining on this cross, and I say, yes, you are there. Now that's an image and a story that probably has more purchase for people who have a profound Christian faith. But his point here really is to suggest how theodical functions work for people. For instance, it suggests here consolation for life's woes. It has a curious otherworldly, transcendent quality. And the symbolism of the cross as a metaphor for redemption and future salvation evokes the Christian eschatology. It suggests that in the end things will be all right. Given the declining role of religion then, especially in Western Europe, and the importance of theodicy in maintaining the social world, it's kind of obvious, isn't it, that we have to ask the question, how does this happen in modern society? How does consumerism defend itself against anomie? What are the structures and devices that allow it to establish cognitive, moral and emotional meaning in the world? And how are they legitimated? How are these meanings legitimated in the face of suffering and loss? In other words, where is the consumerist theodicy? And I want to argue, of course, that modern society has internalized these functions in very specific ways within the dynamics and organization of consumerism. Since every society needs a sacred canopy, and since every sacred canopy has to be legitimated and defended, then it would be really surprising if this were not the case for the consumer society. At first, though, the idea that material commodities, consumer goods, play any part in the establishment of the social world is a kind of an odd one. So I have to do a little bit of work for you in making that link. From a functional perspective, one thinks of material goods mainly as fulfilling certain physical or physiological tasks in the world. My car gets me from A to B. Psychological and social tasks are more obviously construed in terms of less material constructs, thoughts, conversations, norms, institutions perhaps. How is it that goods themselves can be asked to do this work? This is one of the key lessons from the sociology of consumption. It's now broadly accepted, and of course, at one level, it stands to reason, that material things are deeply implicated in the social and the psychological aspects of our lives. And this depends on a uniquely human capability, which is to imbue pure stuff with symbolic meaning. Material goods come to embody symbolic meanings. And this ability of goods to be evocative in terms of our social and psychological meanings is precisely what allows for a kind of osmosis between the physical, material world and the social, psychological, cultural, and indeed, arguably, spiritual world. Those aspects of our lives are continually mediated by the symbolic role of goods. I just want to illustrate that briefly with a wonderful example from a consumer study by the psychologist Csikszentmihalyi, and his co-author Rochberg Holton dates back to the 1980s, but it's called The Meaning of Things. It's a wonderful book. And he interviews a number of respondents. One of them is an 8-year-old North American boy. And the interviewer asks, what do all your special objects taken together mean to you? And the boy replies, they make me feel like I'm part of the world. How do they do that? Because when I look at them, I keep my eyes on them and I think what they mean. Like I have a bank from the First National, and when I look at it, I think what it means. It means money for our cities and our countries. It means tax for the government. My stuffed bunny reminds me of wildlife. All the rabbits and dogs and cats. That toy animal over there reminds me of circuses and the way they train the animals so they don't get hurt. That's what I mean. All my special things make me feel like I'm part of the world. And you can probably supply plenty of your own examples of the evocative power of material goods. Broadly speaking, the view of consumer society that emerges from this is one in which material goods allow us to maintain social conversations about the things that are important to us. An individual's main objective in consumption, said Mary Douglas, is to help create the social world and to find in it a credible place. Material goods, in other words, are absolutely at the centre, deeply implicated in the task of world construction and maintenance, in a social and psychological as much as in a physical sense. But the question remains, how does this consumer society, this materially imbued consumer society, address theodicy? And in particular, can we find any evidence in the way that consumerism operates for the specific theodical functions that I identified in religious theodicy? So let's start. Let's have a look. Justice. In fact, we can find concerns about justice almost everywhere in the consumerist society. And the distribution of goods runs like a constant refrain through consumerism. It's evident in the language of consumer sovereignty, equal opportunity, fair trade, freedom of choice. Evidence of the importance of fairness is uncovered in qualitative studies on consumer attitudes. I sat on something called the Sustainable Consumption Roundtable about 18 months ago, and we did this wonderful study, a consumer group with about 200 people in Manchester, in which they were asked on the first evening to talk about their own aspirations for life over the next 10 years, without telling them, without letting on that we were concerned about planetary sustainability. And what emerged from that was a fascinating discourse where security concerns, anxieties about security, emerged spontaneously, and where the responses to those were, you know, for example, fast cars, big houses and holidays in the sun. It was like a leitmotif through these concerns about the security of the world and the state of the planet that the consumerist answer was a sort of escapism encapsulated in those ways. But there was also a concern that this should be fairly distributed. Why should only the privileged few have access to these delights, fast cars and big houses? The consumerist ideal has to allow everyone the possibility of this access if it is not to be condemned from within. How does it achieve that? At the macroeconomic level, at the big scale, it does it in a very explicit way. The entire ethos of consumerism is legitimated by allegiance to the idea that consumption growth is, as President Kennedy described 40-something years ago, a rising tide that will eventually lift all boats. The fact that it doesn't at the moment lift those boats, of course, stands as a flaw in the theodicy and a condemnation of consumerism. But there, at least, is consumerism's attempt at justice. Cars, I've already mentioned, we don't really need very much reminding of the symbolic importance of cars. The idea that consumerism offers reward for people is incredibly widespread. And in a meritocratic society, where high consumption lifestyles and celebrity status are regarded as the pinnacle of achievement, the whole discourse of consumption is about reward for good behaviour. And here's another wonderful quote to illustrate that. "My Cadillac has become to me a thing I deserve. I wonder if others say things. I've had comments, 'You're rich,' from customers. They may even resent it. I don't care. It shows you make so much more money. It represents my right to own something associated with successful people." And even, interestingly, those with religious backgrounds tend to use the metaphor of reward to legitimate. Their own consumer behaviour. And this was one of the responses from our qualitative study of religious groups. "I find myself standing in the middle of the shop and actually praying, having an argument with God. I really don't need that." No, you don't need it, but you're allowed to treat yourself sometimes. The link between consumption and ontological security, the management of deep underlying uncertainties, is also very well supported in the evidence. "The human animal is a beast that dies," said Big Daddy in Tennessee Williams' play A Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. "And if he's got money, he buys and buys and buys. And I think the reason he buys everything he can is that in the back of his mind he has the crazy hope that one of his purchases will be life everlasting." And what precisely, in terms of terror management, are we to make of President Bush's epoch-defining call to arms in the wake of the 9/11 tragedy? Mrs. Bush and I would like to encourage Americans everywhere to go out shopping. Terror management is really key to the point here. There's a fascinating set of literature around, which flows from Ernest Becker's wonderful book, The Denial of Death. And terror management theory has a modern equivalent, a lot of psychological experimentation around how people manage terror. And there are some absolutely fascinating experiments. These experiments show that when people are exposed to cues that make them more aware of death, heightened mortality salience is what the psychologists call it, they tend to act in ways that enhance their own self-esteem and protect their cultural worldview. This is quite a well-established finding now in psychology. And in a consumer society where self-esteem striving has profoundly materialistic outcomes, just like George Bush asks them to, they go out shopping. Fascinatingly, there is some evidence, and we can discuss that later, that this urge is moderated in people who express strong allegiance to some faith. So moving on to consolation. Our apparent addiction to material things can't be entirely construed, I think, in hedonistic or materialistic ways. Yes, perhaps there is something pathological about the intensity with which we cling to material goods. "Hollow hands clasp ludicrous possessions," wrote Ernest Dichter in 1964, "because they are links in the chain of life. If it breaks, they are truly lost." But material goods also facilitate consolation in very, very precise ways. Sacred goods remind us of those we love, of dreams we hold, of hopes for the future, and at a more mundane level, the seemingly endless availability consoles us for the temporary nature of our lives, for our disappointments and our failures. It assures us that society holds out the promise of better lives for us and for our descendants in the future. And that's a clearly suggestive of a kind of consumerist eschatology. That the final state of affairs is not a final state at all, in fact. Rather, it's a continually increasing flow of goods, making the world a better and better place. Not just for us, but for our descendants. The evocative power of material things allows us to protect our harsh ideals, from the harsh scrutiny of daylight, by offering us a continual hope for a better world. But for goods to serve this cause of hope, as Grant McCracken has pointed out, they have to be inexhaustible in supply. And so it's precisely their failure to satisfy us that makes them valuable in terms of the theodicy. We have to continue to desire these goods. We have to have them in continual supply. Because, in fact, their role is not functional in a purely physical sense. It is about maintaining our hope. And it's precisely that ability that is both deeply locked in how consumerism works as a theodicy and perverse, of course. The end game played out by consumerism is at one level one in which the ability to go on consuming for generation after generation is the ultimate goal, a kind of heaven on earth. Vincent Miller, a theologian, has argued that in fact consumerism, consumer desire, has derailed eschatology by allowing desire itself to become the object of human striving. Consumer seduction, he says, is constituted against a horizon of possibility. It's constantly looking beyond the present for more fulfilling alternatives. Expectation is endlessly aroused, but this expectation is as shallow as it is broad. Joy is sought in desire itself. Consumer anticipation is at heart a way of accommodating the endless repeat of the same, of finding pleasure in a world without hope. The consumer eschatology, in this view, is a kind of anti-eschatology, a study in denial of the fear that things will ultimately turn out badly for all of us. Where will it all end? So, in summary, what I've tried to show is that consumerism has appropriated at least some of the functions of theodicy through the role that material goods play in our lives. And as I've indicated, we can't afford to think of this theodicy as entirely pathological, but it is clearly flawed. Its conceptualization of justice is tenuous, its framing and disbursement of rewards is iniquitous. It is deeply and perhaps perversively seductive in offering a fleeting kind of ontological security, one that needs continually to be reinforced by more consumption. It does provide a form of transcendence, but the degree to which this facilitates any real hope or consolation for our losses is suspect. Far from creating a credible eschatology, consumerism appears to be a continuous exercise in denial of our own mortality and of the widespread suffering in the world. And as Kenneth Turing, another theologian, remarked in relation to the theodicy, a theodicy is not worth heeding if it does not allow the screams of our world to be heard. What are the implications of this in terms of countering consumerism? To me, it's clear that consumerism can't be countered by exhortation, religious or otherwise. If consumption plays such a vital role in the construction and maintenance of the social world, then asking people to give up material commodities is asking them to risk a kind of social suicide. People will resist threats to their identity. They'll resist threats to their meaning. They will ask quite legitimate questions of the moral persuaders and the motives of those moral persuaders. What right do you have to tell me what I should and shouldn't consume? So the task of countering consumerism must start with the building of alternative theodicies, the building of meaning structures, communities of meaning perhaps, that lie outside, and they must lie outside, the realm of the market. And I would argue, a deep re-engagement with theodicy, the problem of pain, the problem of evil. Credible answers to the deep foundational questions that continue to haunt us. Where on earth will it end? Ultimately, of course, as Annie's death reminds us, it pretty much always, in one sense, ends badly. Nobody knows exactly what Annie died from. There's a lot of conjecture. The most often repeated one is that she died from consumption. It's a personal tragedy, and we all have personal tragedies. At the heart of what I'm talking about is the question of loss and of our own mortality. The Buddhist obsession with suffering is of course profoundly distasteful to modern Western attitudes, which may be why we hear more about the Buddhist enlightenment side of the philosophy than we do about the basis for Buddhism, which is the recognition that everything is suffering. That's not a very popular starting point, but the contemplation of death does serve a very useful purpose. It reminds us constantly of the emptiness of consumer society, of the emptiness of consumerist lives. It serves to remind us that there's more at stake here. It serves to remind us of the suffering of others, persistent poverty, the extinction of species, the health of the global climate. The fate of this disappearing world still hangs in the balance, alongside our own more parochial concerns. And whatever the theodicy that we come up with, and let's hope we manage to, that probably has to be the starting point. Thank you very much.